Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The ballots are counted in Iraq. The numbers are in, but the meaning of the vote is still a puzzle. The Sunnis, who once ruled under Saddam Hussein, essentially sat out the election. The secular Shiite Prime Minister Iyad Alawi, Washington's hope, came in a distant third. Islamic cleric-backed Shiites with ties to Iran will hold a majority of the interim assembly seats, but not enough to endorse a new constitution without the big vote of the Kurds. And they are not even sure they want to be part of Iraq. Tonight on Point, Iraq's election outcome and what it means for Iraq and America. We begin in Baghdad, where yesterday's official election tally has set up a season of intense political negotiation and horse trading. John Diamond is a reporter in Baghdad for USA Today. I asked him to give us his headline out of Iraq's election results.
I think the headline is a disappointing result for the Shiites, even though they got the most votes. And so now it's a matter of coalition building, a kind of deal-making democracy that is totally unfamiliar to Iraqis.
Is this good for Iraqi stability? Does this mean it will require power sharing, or does this set up a power struggle and instability?
I could see it breaking either way, and I don't even think the experts know. The better case scenario is that the fact that the majority party, the Shia, have to make a deal will make it less likely that they would have used their larger majority to sort of lord it over everybody and impose their will, which could have brought about a violent reaction. So the idea that they got a smaller result could be good in terms of requiring that they make a deal and thereby keeping the various parties less unhappy. The other side of the coin would be the idea that with no strong figure or strong party in charge, you'll have a sort of division of power that could result in a weak central government and therefore some chaos and violence, particularly in some of the disputed places like Kirkuk up in the north, the oil-rich city up there.
Now, the minority Sunnis pretty much on the sidelines, having boycotted largely this vote. Shiites with their turnout, Kurds with a very strong turnout. John, take us through the numbers, if you would. What do we see here in the results?
The way the balloting translates into seats, we've got a 275-seat National Assembly. It looks as though the Shiites will control a little more than half of that. The Sunni, at the low end of the scale, will have roughly 5 seats in the National Assembly. The Kurdish party will get a little over 70 seats. And then coming in third place, the Alawi party, they will perhaps get a couple of dozen.
That is the sitting prime minister, the secular Shiite.
Yep, the sitting prime minister, which is a disappointing result for him. He is trying to do some political jockeying in order to be named prime minister in this newly formed government. The National Assembly is going to name the top 3 positions. A 2/3 majority will be required to do so. As you can see from the map, nobody's got that 2/3 majority. None of the major factions has a 2/3 majority. So there's going to have to be some give and take in order to name these positions, and there will likely be power sharing. Whether a Sunni figure ends up with one of these top jobs now looks very doubtful.
So maybe 140 seats for the clerically endorsed Shiites, 75 seats or so for the alliance of Iraq's 2 main Kurdish parties, and everybody else following along in train. They will, as you say, first name a government, and then they'll have to, by October, I believe, hammer out a constitution and come to a 2/3 endorsement of it. Does that look possible, or is that still an open question?
That's still an open question. The interim government, this is also going to continue to be called an interim government. It could be extended by another 6 months under the provisions of the charter that was established. So it has some wiggle room there. My guess would be they'd probably end up using that wiggle room and take the deadline to the absolute last minute.
The leading Shiite party then, that is the one backed by the endorsed by the Grand Ayatollah Sistani, has this absolute majority, but nowhere near the two-thirds it's needed. They will need the Kurds. What do the Kurds want in order to come on board? What are their bottom-line requirements?
The main thing they've been asking for, of course, is a large measure of political autonomy, which they have enjoyed over the past decade. They are sort of an anomaly among Iraqi populations in that they've had it pretty good over the past 10 years while the rest of the country was being repressed by Saddam. They've been more or less independent. Saddam did not have power on the ground in the Kurdish section of northern Iraq. It was essentially under UN control. They've been collecting taxes. They've been running the border. They've been getting oil revenue, and they don't want to let that go. They have a lot to lose. They want to hold on to that autonomy. The setting up of a viable national government will probably involve requiring them to yield some of that autonomy.
We hear they also want Kirkuk, the oil-rich city, to be included in the Kurdish area of Iraq. So some real tensions here. What are American officials in Baghdad saying about this outcome, John?
They've maintained a very low profile. They're trying to appear to be standing aside to let a sovereign Iraqi government work it out. They claim in their public and background statements that they have no favored or desired outcome other than stability and a sense of rights for all of the parties involved and of participation in the democracy. So the U.S. position officially is hands-off while this process works itself out. There has been a longstanding U.S. policy that Iraq remain one country, and to the extent that Kurdish autonomy may threaten that, the U.S. policy would at some point run into that as a major problem.
So a celebrated election and an outcome that's a glass half full or a glass half empty, depending how you look at it. John Diamond, thanks for laying it out for us.
Very welcome.
John Diamond is a reporter for USA Today. He spoke with me from Baghdad. We are talking tonight about Iraq's election outcome and what it holds for that country and for the future of U.S. involvement there. You can join the conversation. What's your take on the final tally from Baghdad? When the Kurds and Shiites split the pie, is that a recipe for negotiation or for meltdown? Are Iraq's prospects looking up? What do you think? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Shakir Mustafa. He's an assistant professor of Arabic and Muslim studies at Boston University. He's originally from Iraq and is in close touch with his family, still living in Baghdad, including his mother, brother, sister, nieces, and nephews. He also closely monitors developments in Iraq through the region's news media. Shakir Mustafa, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So your first thoughts as you watch these results tumble out over the weekend, you're watching from abroad, as many Iraqis are. What do you make of this outcome?
I think it's thrilling to see a country having elections for the first time in, say, 5 decades to pretty much demonstrate an admirable understanding of the democratic process, not only during the election where Iraqis braved death and serious injury to cast their votes, but also after the elections. Their understanding of the process of deal-making, sharing of power, their interest in having division of power that somehow satisfies the people who got the most votes. These are things we cannot underestimate.
So you're sanguine, you're optimistic that they're going to continue negotiating, horse trading, talking in democratic style. To come up with a solution here that's acceptable to everybody, but do everyone's interests really fit together?
I hope they will continue. So far, after the election, this is what I have been getting from Iraq and from the newspapers. There will be a lot of challenges and a lot of pressures, and it remains to be seen whether these different political factions will be able to emerge as a cohesive democratic body for the new government.
8.5 million voters turned out despite all the threats that were there. That's something like 58%, and that with the Sunnis boycotting
that
almost outright.
That is surprising by any measure.
What do you hear from your relatives in Baghdad? Did they vote, and how have they found the aftermath? Is everyone sitting around waiting? Were they waiting on pins and needles for these results?
They voted. They voted, and they have hopes and expectations. What bothers me, however, is that they do not really seem to understand what they voted for or the coalition or the lists they voted for. They did not know a lot of the candidates. There was not enough time for campaigning.
Or enough security to safely
Absolutely.
Campaign.
And the problem is that they had to fall back on conventional values, tribal values, religious associations, sectarian feelings, rather than an embracing of a genuinely democratic process.
We're reading here that about 80% of Iraqis voted for parties that represented their own ethnic or religious group. Your family is Shiite, but I don't know if they're secular or religious in their orientation. Maybe they're both, depending who you're talking about.
They are secular. They voted for the major Shiite coalition, which is not particularly secular, simply because they wanted to identify with a larger piece of the pie. That is their gut feeling.
So they didn't go with Iyad Alawi, the prime minister's more secular-oriented, I guess it wasn't even Shiite, but a kind of coalition.
Absolutely.
They went with the one endorsed by the Grand Ayatollah,
yes.
Sistani.
Yeah, Sistani seemed to have more power with them. That is the thing.
Are they concerned that Iraq may end up an Islamic republic?
I think they are accepting the rhetoric coming from the Shiite coalition that it is going to be a secular government. I'm particularly skeptical about this. I think they are pragmatic, and they are not particularly laying all their cards on the table right now. But as a secular person, I have genuine concerns that the Shiite coalition will be as secular as it has been.
You're afraid it may not be, that it in fact may go down the Islamic path.
That's a genuine concern.
Shakir Mustafa, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about Iraq's election outcome and what it holds for the future of the country and the U.S. involvement there. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Iraq's election outcome out over the weekend and what it holds for the future of that country and for the U.S. involvement there. You can join the conversation tonight. The election turnout was a victory in itself. Now, what about these election results? Are Iraq's prospects looking up? And when Shia and Kurds split the pie, is that a recipe for negotiation or meltdown? And when it went to war, did Washington expect or intend to deliver an Islamic cleric-backed majority friendly to Iran? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by Shakir Mustafa. He is an Iraqi native, now assistant professor of Islamic and Arabic studies at Boston University, following events there very closely. With us from Washington is Najmalden Karim. He is president of the Washington Kurdish Institute, a nonprofit organization established in 1996 to introduce Kurdish issues to an American audience. Najmalden Karim, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
And with us from Washington, Laith Kuba, senior program officer for the Middle East at the National Endowment for Democracy. He's Iraqi as well and was involved for a long time in planning for a potential post-Saddam government. Laith Kuba, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Najmalden Karim, to you first. A very substantial showing for the Kurds in this election. And they are right there in the number two position in terms of representation in this interim National Assembly that will write a constitution. No constitution will be endorsed, it would appear, without them. Does this look like a relationship that can work with the leading Shiite party at the top and the Kurds right behind as the necessary swing vote?
Yes, we hope that it will work. It is, as you said, is a big advantage for the Kurds to have come out and voted. About 85% turnout was in the Kurdistan region.
Huge turnout.
And actually, contrary to the other friend who mentioned that his family didn't know what they were voting for, the Kurds clearly were aware and knew what they were voting for, and they have high expectations in the future.
But let me ask you this. Do the Kurds' deep, long-run interests line up with those of a Shiite government in Baghdad? The Kurds want autonomy, including, we're told, Kirkuk, the oil-rich city and region around it, to be included in their autonomous
Kurdistan region. They also do not, we're told, want an Islamic republic. They want a secular government. Can the Kurds come to an understanding with the leading Shiite party that will guarantee them this? And if they can't, what happens?
Well, first of all, the Kurds are essentially giving up independence to have some guarantees about future Iraqi constitution. Secularism is very important. However, the Kurds are Muslims, as the majority of the people of Iraq, and they understand that there shouldn't be any contradiction between the constitution and Islam. It should not be antagonistic to Islamic beliefs. However, it has to be secular, and actually the major leading figures within the Shia coalition have indicated that that's the way they are looking at the future of the constitution as well. In regard to territorial areas in Kurdistan, of course, one of the main demands that the policy of ethnic cleansing and Arabization that was committed by Saddam Hussein and the regimes before him has to be reversed, and the region of Kurdistan should encompass all areas of Kurdistan, particularly cities such as Kirkuk, Khanaqin, Sinjar, which are historically Kurdish areas.
But you know that Kirkuk comes with a lot of oil. Do you think that any central government in Baghdad can give that up? And if they don't, what will the Kurds do?
Well, as far as the oil is concerned and all the resources in Iraq, there will be revenue sharing by all peoples of Iraq from whatever comes out. However, the local control and production and employment will be under the authority of the Kurdistan Regional Government.
So everybody's sounding very reasonable here tonight. We're going to share the revenues. We're going to be Islamic, but not too Islamic. Leith Kuba, join us here. What's your response to the election results we've seen this weekend?
Well, of course, it's a big positive turning point. I think Iraqis have assumed, after many, many decades, ownership of the process. Of course, differences will emerge, and there is a backlash after years of repression to different nationalities and minorities within Iraq. Of course, there is a strong vocal polarization along these ethnic and religious lines, but I'm fairly confident this is a passing phase. The issues ahead, however, in the next year, this new government or coalition that will form a government has to deliver on a number of issues in a very short period of time. These are the real challenges. On the Constitution, I'm afraid there are some different visions, competing visions. It's not going to be easy to resolve, but I have confidence in the process itself. Iraqis have talked to each other and worked in the past before.
And are these competing visions, are they around how Islamic or secular the government will be and how autonomous the Kurdish region will be?
I think it's among the Kurds, with all respect to Dr. Najm, the overwhelming sentiment that expressed itself, the Kurds ultimately would like to see independence. Now, this they are going to press ahead with. If you look today, not a single Iraqi flag has flown in anywhere in northern Iraq in the Kurdish area. There is a Kurdish flag. So this is a real issue. Politicians cannot dance around it. And ultimately, I think for the rest of the Iraqis, they'd like to know, is it going to be a one Iraq, or are we just simply playing on time and semantics on how to go about it? So this is a real issue that needs to be addressed head on. Another issue, of course, is the role of religion. If you have an increasing public pressure towards having more religion into public life, this is going to press an issue. And in my opinion, the answer to all these issues are going to be in decentralization. That's the only way you can assure that different parts of the country has its own, more or less, management of local affairs without having a center that is over-empowered over the provinces.
Of course, if you have all that autonomy, on the other hand, there's the issue of will the center be strong enough to hold together with these centrifugal forces? Shakir Mustafa here with me in Boston. What's your sense of your degree of confidence in the unity of Iraq going forward with these different factions pulled now into a democratic relationship, but there's a lot of history here?
I'm a little concerned, actually more than a little. what Dr. Najm has called reversing ethnic cleansing in Kirkuk is a matter of concerning of concern to Iraqis. There has been a lot of repression in the Kurdish area, but so was the situation in the entire country. Arabs, Sunnis, and Shiites, everyone who opposed the Saddam regime was repressed.
So you're saying if the Kurds move in to take back territory and houses there and push out Arabic, ethnic Arabs,
I mean, that's
you may have
me,
reverse ethnic
absolutely.
Cleansing?
I think these are matters that should be left to a more stable government that can do it in a more equitable manner. Not anyone who has more tanks, you know, can decide these things as soon as they can.
But are these things, given the history and given the emotions and given the material interests at stake, can Iraqis sit down and negotiate these things as the National Assembly format suggests? Are these negotiable?
They are sitting and they are negotiating, but the Kurds think that they have a mandate now and they are dictating. They are always sending conditions. We got to, you know, they have a green line now, something like borders. Mm. And insisting on the unofficial referendum on independence, something over 90% that the Kurdish population, it's not official, it's not recognized.
Right. But
they
expression
are
of
waving,
clear opinion.
Of course, they are waving these cards, and I think they are somehow pretty much pushing an agenda that scares the other coalitions and other parties in Iraq.
Najmuddin Karim, you hear there sort of the voice of Baghdad looking north at the Kurds, worried that, that the Kurds will push too much, too hard, too far. Can Kurdish leaders satisfy Kurds who have a lot of reason to be concerned, given the history, the gassing and the ethnic cleansing, all the rest? But you hear the voice of the sort of Baghdad perspective saying, don't push too far. This can turn into a problem in the other direction. Can this be bridged?
Well, first of all, what the Kurds, you know, this friend from Boston, he's talking
Shakir
about...
Shakir Mustafa, Mr. Mustafa.
Yes, Mr. Mustafa, Professor Mustafa is talking about who has more tanks. The Kurds have voted. They have not brought in tanks. The Kurds have had actually the ability to do other things, but they have not. The Kurds have always chosen to go about these issues in a democratic way.
Fair enough and true, actually, but down the road, can it stay there?
Article 58 in TAL has been approved by all the major groups that won the election, including Syria, including the INC and the Prime Minister's party. All of them have agreed on this, the Americans and the British, the coalition. They have all agreed on this. And in that article, it says that the people who have been deported and evicted from their homes will go back to their places. The people who have been brought into those places to as settlers and taken over the lands and houses of others will be compensated to go back into places where they came from. My friend Laith Kubba talks about no Iraqi flags in Kurdistan. I don't know why Laith Kubba wants Saddam Hussein's flag with his own handwriting and the United Arab Republic flag flagging. These are not Iraqi flags.
So you're still waiting for a new Iraqi flag to fly?
Of course. The Kurds have always said that this flag does not represent Iraq. This flag was flag of a tyrant, and if this is the symbol they are looking for, I don't think this is new Iraq. Fortunately for the people back there, I think they understand that. They even approved a new flag, but I think finally they decided they didn't like the colors and all that.
Right.
So there will be a new Iraqi flag.
Laith Kubba, lots of mixed messages coming through here. Everybody wants to feel optimistic about this exercise in democracy, and yet we can't even exactly agree on what flag to fly. What's your level of optimism?
Well, I am optimistic. I think, come what may, I have deep faith in people. I have deep faith in the history of Iraq, in what binds Iraqis together. I don't have much trust in politicians. I think there is a lot of vested interest. I think extreme nationalism, both on the Arab side and on the Kurdish side, have done more harm to Iraq than good. I think, by and large, if we have a process and things settle down, common sense will prevail. Iraqis would see will see that they have a 1,000-2,000-year history that bound them together, that the best interest of their children can be served by integrating their resources, human resources, and natural resources, and that Iraq can really become the beacon for the Middle East.
So it sounds good, but as you say, you don't have much confidence in politicians. Politicians are the ones who get elected. A lot more questions, but I want to begin to bring our callers in here. Anwar is calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Hi, Anwar, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just got two clarifications. The first one is that I keep hearing a reference to the alliance which won the majority as the Shi'as party.
Well, the United Iraqi Alliance, it is Shiite-dominated.
Well, it's Shiite-dominated, but it has other parties within it.
Yes.
And as well as many groups and personalities. One of the groups, for instance, is that of Ahmad Chalabi, which is secular.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. I mean, many elements there, but certainly Shiite-dominated.
It's Shiite-dominated, but that's not Shiite's party.
Okay, okay.
The clarification is that the election spread across a wide spectrum. For example, apart from the three groups, the Alliance, the Kurds, and Alawis,
yes.
A Sunni party headed by Aliyawar won 5 seats, the Turkmen won 3 seats, and another Shi'ites party, which is very much allied or friendly with the Muqtada Sadr, won also 3 seats.
But what do those matter? They're so small.
They're so small, but they still have a voice to say, and so when you have a power play,
yeah.
Even the small matters. For example, the Communist Party won 3 seats also.
And when they're trying to put together the 2/3 later to approve this constitution, who knows exactly what coalition they'll find?
I definitely agree with you. I'm not arguing. Just saying as a matter of fact.
Yep.
But it's one remark I would like to say is that we keep hearing about the security issue and about whether Iraq is going to be secular or not. I believe one of the most important matters that have not been touched or received due diligence is that of the economy. Unless the wheel of the domestic economy starts turning and turning fast and turning efficiently, Iraq is going to continue to suffer from terrorism and from abuse.
Anwar, we've got it. You've given us a lot to chew on there. Let us dive into it. Let's start with the Sunni issue. Shakir Mustafa, overwhelmingly boycotted by Sunnis.
Yeah.
5 seats, as our caller Anwar points out of 275. Could be important in coalition, but represents nothing like the power they once had. Some number of those Sunnis engaged in the insurgency. How does this new political array deal with the Sunnis who are on the sidelines, who don't have any swing weight in this democracy right now?
What came out of them is some regret that they did not participate, that they need to participate in the democratic process. That's a good sign, I think. It might be a little too late simply because the votes have been cast and those who got seats are not going to surrender them.
But there's another vote coming if they came back in numbers in December, if that vote takes place on schedule.
Absolutely. I think now they are more organized. They want to talk to the major power brokers, to the Shiites, to the Kurds, and they want their voices heard.
Leif Kuba, do you see the Sunnis coming back in through the ballot box or primarily through the gun?
No, I do see the ballot box. I do see them, I think, as Shakir Mustafa said, there is a real sense and a widespread sense of regret that they were misled by the calls to boycott, that they can see the prospects of really achieving a lot of what they wanted if they were participants in their real numbers in this process. However, having said that, I don't think we should confuse the political process with the insurgency. I don't think the majority of Sunnis are supporting the insurgency, but the insurgency has been hiding behind them. With this political process, the insurgency have lost not only the political argument, but the moral argument too. However, they still have guns and they have networks, and I think they will be more intense trying to disrupt the process. But by and large, I think the Sunnis are going to come back to the process. Next elections is going to be much better.
And who gains, who loses? Do they cut in? Who's showing do they cut into if they come back to the table?
Well, I think Iraq gains because
overall, yeah.
Ultimately, you just cannot have stability with one community unhappy about what goes on. Iraq suffered for too long when the Kurds were not happy with the political system, and although they were in the north, that was a cause of instability in Iraq. Imagine if this cuts across all the way to Baghdad. And those people were part of the backbone of the Iraqi state before. So it's just impossible in a pragmatic point of view.
Leif Kuba in Washington, stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight about Iraq's election outcome and what it holds for the future of that country. Listeners, you can join the conversation with the Sunni on the sidelines. What do the results mean for the insurgency? And does the outcome get the United States closer to withdrawal? Or not. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Iraq's election outcome, the vote, the tally, and what it holds for the future of Iraq, for the future of America's involvement there. You can join the conversation tonight. 4 years ago, let's say, did you ever imagine that you'd be poring over the details of Iraqi election outcomes? What a world we're in. What kind of surprising changes sometimes? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're hearing a lot tonight about negotiation, about horse trading, about possibilities, but there's also talk in the background about civil war, about deep divisions, about insurgency, about the interests of Iran next door. What do you think? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Washington by Najmalden Karim. He is president of the Washington Kurdish Institute. Also in Washington, Leif Kuba, with the National Endowment for Democracy there. And with me in the studio tonight, Shakir Mustafa, a native of Iraq also, and assistant professor now of Islamic Studies and Arabic at Boston University. Fritz is calling from Richland Center, Wisconsin. Hi, Fritz. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. My question is the following. In 1969, when the Ba'ath, the Arab Socialist Party, the Ba'ath Party, came to power, They had a general amnesty. The amnesty facilitated the participation in the Iraq country of, say, the people who were in the King Faisal Nuri Assad government that was overthrown in 1958.
So there'd been a lot of trouble, they said, general amnesty, and are you suggesting the same thing now, Fritz?
Yes, absolutely. Well, it seems to me that it would clear the air. General amnesty does, of course, mean everyone is amnestied. We're not talking about the people that were in the so-called deck of cards that are under lock and key now.
So, but after all the killing under Saddam Hussein, the gassing of the Kurds, bombings, the beheadings, everybody.
I'm not suggesting that the people who were the gangsters in the Saddam regime should be let off. I'm just for instance, the people who were teachers at the University of Baghdad. You know, what kind of future do they have?
So you're saying let the amnesty grow wider. This gets, and thank you for your call, Fritz. Leif Kuba, this gets to your point about the Ba'ath Party still being there. What is the best way? I mean, Fritz is saying let's have a general amnesty. Is there a role for an amnesty here? What about, we hear other voices saying that there still needs to be more, I'm not sure of the right phrase, but cleanup of the Ba'ath Party holdovers in different institutions. How do you see it?
Well, let me respond to the caller's question. In fact, this issue has been the subject of many meetings and conferences.
Yeah.
Many other countries went through the same experience, something called transitional justice, setting up procedures. How do you deal with the past and clean it up?
Yep.
And there are many norms and standards, and nobody suggests that just membership of the Ba'ath Party is the reason for punishing a person or sacking them or letting them lose their job. And if that happened in the past, everybody acknowledges this is a big mistake.
But are there still divisions in Iraq today being perpetuated by the fear of Iraqis who may have some blemish in their background, so they're afraid to come into the new government, the new setting?
Of course there is, and I don't share the sentiment that there should be a general amnesty. I think this has to go through a procedure. I really believe the feeling amongst Iraqis is so strong that there must be a procedure really to differentiate who was responsible for these crimes, and some justice must be seen done. But I agree totally that it must not be left in vague terms, otherwise this would help the instability in the country. We really must tackle it. Many studies have been done on this. None of them has been implemented yet properly, and there are different views about to what extent you go after the Ba'athist and at what level, but there is consensus that those who are responsible for crimes ultimately must be punished.
Let's get another call here. John is calling from Fort Knox, Kentucky. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. How are you doing today?
We're great. What's on your mind, John?
I was wanting to make the comment about Iraq, because I really, as a soldier, you really don't get to make comments very often.
When were you a soldier and where, John?
I'm still a soldier down at Fort Knox.
Okay.
Now.
Have you been in Iraq?
Yes.
All right. We're all ears. What do you think?
Well, you know, when you first go over, when a lot of soldiers first went over there, you thought and you knew you were doing a great thing for the people. But as you spent more time over there, you came to realize that the people weren't helping you help them, and they were against you. The same guy that the government would hire to help you and, like, your fobs and things like that would be the same guy that would give people locations on what to bomb in your fob.
John, the Iraqis did go out to vote in pretty large numbers. Is that a sign of Iraqis picking up their own fate, their own destiny?
It is, and I really hope that when we get out of there that they'll stay the way they are right now. And us over there right now is helping them a great deal,
mm-hmm.
by far. But once we leave, it's kind of scary because you think, are those same people going to come out of the woodworks and just turn it right back to where it was before?
Into a kind of mess. John, thanks very much for your call from Fort Knox there. Shakir Mustafa, how about it? A lot of Americans wondering tonight, when do we get out of there? What's the role we're playing? And our soldier, John,
absolutely.
Saying he was there,
yeah.
and he felt Iraqis were not picking up the weight of their own future.
I agree with that sentiment as well, simply because I don't think they were ready to participate, to cooperate with an occupying power. What they are insisting on now is an exit policy for the United States, and I think the United States needs to recognize this and start working.
Are you saying set a date like Ted Kennedy asks, or don't set a date like President Bush insists?
An exit strategy, a timetable of sorts, saying that we will pull, say, I don't know, 10-15% of our forces by this date and so on and so forth. They need to indicate to the Iraqis that they are not there to stay for decades, as it has been said earlier.
Mm. Yes, is that late Cuba?
Can I?
Who am I talking to?
This is Dr. Karim. Can I?
Yes, please, Dr. Karim.
I've been
yes.
listening, and
please.
You, I think you kind of forgot about me.
Come to me, my friend.
First of all, I think that what that soldier said may be true in Sana'a and other parts of Iraq, but in Kurdistan, not a single American soldier has been attacked, wounded, or killed. As a matter of fact, they go there to get their rest and recreation.
Now, I have to ask you exactly why you're making that point. Are you now drawing a distinction between Kurdistan and the rest of Iraq, and for what purpose?
Yes, I do, and the reason for that, I think this approach about the Sunnis that both my colleagues are talking about is probably what is missing, why we have the Sunnis, the Sunni areas in so much
turmoil.
Turmoil, and the reason for that is whether some people admit it or not, Iraq is really composed of different ethnic and religious groups.
So what should we take away from that? Should they go hammer and tongs after the Sunnis? Should they divide the country into
all? And that's exactly what the point I'm trying to get at.
Yes.
Just like the Shia areas, because it's ruled somehow by whether it's their tribal leaders, their religious leader, mm-hmm. or in Kurdistan by their own leaders, I think the Sunni areas also need to be allowed to have their own representation before they get into a central government where it could be controlled, or they have the fear that it will be controlled by the Shiites and oppress them and take revenge on them.
So the Kurdish flag is raised here, autonomy for the Kurds, and you're saying even for the Sunni.
Absolutely. I think that is what is needed. That is what is the whole idea about federalism or even a confederation between the Sunni, the Shia, and the Kurdish area.
Well, Late Cuba, please.
Can I come here?
Yes, please.
With all respect to my...
Well, I didn't finish yet, Leith, because...
Our time is short. Please, quickly, Dr. Karim.
Time is short, because the Sunnis have controlled Iraq. They have oppressed the Shiites, the Sunnis, for decades. They are afraid that now they will be controlled by the others and the same thing will be done to
them. We understand that.
And it's not so much they don't realize that they will never go back and control the whole country like they did, but there is that fear. I have Sunni colleagues, Arabs, they talk about these things, and this is real. This is
genuine. Dr. Karim, duly noted. Let me get Leith Kuba's response.
Well, I beg to differ with my good old friend, Dr. Najm, because for two reasons. I think what he's articulating is a vision that Iraq is made basically of three communities, and maybe this is the way the state should be structured. There is very much another vision, and I can argue strongly that it's more accurate, is that although Iraq is made of these three communities, but over the last 80 years, the intermarriages and the mixing between these communities, if you look at the largest community in Iraq and try to ask people how many of you either came from mixed marriages or are in mixed marriages or their children are in mixed marriages, then I assure you get more than 60% of the Iraqis in that category. And that actually should lead us to the conclusion that it is critical for Iraq to become a modern secular state that transcends ethnic and religious affiliation, and that is the only way the interests of the people, by and large, in that country can be served. It's extremely dangerous to try to draw lines, divide land on people if they are so intermixed.
I've got it, and we've just got half a minute left here, but Shakir Mustafa, it brings us right to the nub of this, whether this country will stay together. This is what this new National Assembly will now have to hash out, and we've come tonight.
There are excellent chances. There is an understated resentment of sectarian divisions. You don't hear about this from politicians simply because...
Don't divide us by sectarian background.
Absolutely.
But if your family was gassed in Kurdistan, you may feel those divisions.
I do, but my family is Shiite, and sometimes they get upset that all we talk about are Sunnis and Shiites, and I think this is true of the Sunnis as well.
See us by what binds us together. That is a good note to go out on, talking about democracy. We'll be watching to see how it works. Shakir Mustafa from Boston University, thank you very much for joining us
tonight. Thank you for having me.
Leith Kuba, Senior Program Officer for the Middle East at the National Endowment for Democracy in Washington, thank you very much for being
thank
with
you.
Us tonight. And Dr. Najmaldeen Karim, President of the Washington Kurdish Institute, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
In a moment, a look inside the Bush administration's $82 billion supplemental budget. This is On Point. Make that another $82 billion, please. It was just last Monday that President Bush submitted his $2.5 trillion budget for 2006. Today, he formally asked Congress for more money for a so-called supplemental budget. The additional $82 billion would be used overwhelmingly to cover the costs of war in Iraq plus Afghanistan, then the construction of a new U.S. embassy in Baghdad, aid for tsunami victims, and more. The Defense Department would get $75 billion of it and use $5 billion to restructure Army divisions and brigades. Both houses of Congress will have to vote on the request. Keeping a close watch on all these developments is Harry Zeev, National Field Director for the Concord Coalition, a nonpartisan fiscal watchdog group. He joins me now from Vienna, Virginia. Harry Zeev, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Let me ask you, first of all, this is $82 billion, and it's not included in the budget. That's a big chunk of change to be outside the budget. Is the Bush administration justified in presenting this as a supplemental budget not within the normal boundaries?
Well, it certainly feels justified in doing so because they felt before that they simply couldn't put a figure on what these things would cost and held off until now to put dollar signs on each of the items that are going to be covered.
But there's a lot of things in an ordinary budget that we don't know the precise cost of, and yet they're included in the main budget. Is this a dodge? You're the watchdog, so we're counting on you to tell us. Is this a dodge, or is this reasonable?
It's very hard to look inside the heart of an administration, but it kind of smells dodgy to us.
I'm looking in here, and there's a lot that goes for Iraq. And, of course, we're now up to something like $300 billion and running with this that will have been allocated for Iraq. and Afghanistan tucked in there. But then there are other things here. What, $950 million for tsunami relief. I don't know if that's typical in a supplemental budget.
That typically is, because that's unforeseen.
An emergency.
It's impossible to predict an emergency like that.
Okay.
Right?
$660 million for construction of a new U.S. embassy in Baghdad. Supplemental material?
Potentially, although it's very hard to say. They didn't know they would be incurring costs to build a massive embassy.
Right. $200 million in education and border security aid for the Palestinians.
It's hard to say whether or not that was something that was anticipatable or whether or not it was a legit emergency, something new and unanticipated.
Hmm.
But I think if you follow the process, we knew we would be incurring costs at some point. Maybe that's not the worst of the items in there.
Well, the real big money one gets back to the military. The Army wants to use $5 billion to convert 33 brigades and regiments into a force of 40 to 48 that would operate more independently. It's a kind of force restructuring. Justified as a supplemental cost?
Very questionable, at least to us. That's the kind of thing that has been in the works for a long time. You don't suddenly, as an emergency, decide to restructure. So we've got a bit of a problem viewing that as a legit emergency, unanticipated cost.
Harry Zeev, the administration says that no one should be upset about this because the $82 billion, while it's in a supplemental budget here, the number will be built into the administration's overall deficit projections. Do you agree? Is that what you see happening?
It will eventually, yes. It'll be in the actual dollars at the end of the year that are spent.
But when President Bush says he's going to cut the deficit in half by, 2008, 2009, will that be from a point that includes this $82 billion or not?
It will be.
It will.
That makes it all the more difficult for him to get there. On top of which, it assumes, if you're talking about that 2009, 2010 time frame, that this is the last time we're going to spend money on operations in Iraq or Afghanistan.
And we know that's not true.
We've got a real problem thinking that that's going to be the case.
So what does all this mean about U.S. fiscal policy? Is it just that much more out of whack than the government is generally conceding?
It's one real symptom of the disconnect between the rhetoric and the reality. It's very much a symptom of that.
Harry Zeev, do you expect supplemental budgets to go on indefinitely at the Concord Coalition when you do your calculations? The war on terror, we're told, is what? I've heard, John Ashcroft saying 50 years. Did he say a century once? Does that mean we'll perpetually have supplemental budgets that get dropped on after the main budget's delivered?
Certainly that's the trend right now. It's a trend that we don't think is healthy because it's simply not honest budgeting. Let's take a look at our needs, the dollars coming in, the dollars going out, and try to match up revenues the best we can with expenses. This administration and this Congress, at least at the moment, seem to show little appetite for doing that.
Not doing it right now. Harry Zeev, thank you so much for giving us some interpretation tonight.
Sure, thank you.
Harry Zeev, National Field Director for the Concord Coalition. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Rachel Dornhelm, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Tim Skog, Michael Garth, Angel Cozzelli, and Leslie Moore Mira. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.